Chapter 18. Landon Again.
When I first heard that Thursday was back in Swindon, I was delighted. I never fully believed that she had gone for good. I had heard of her problems in London, and I also knew how she reacted to stress. All of us who returned from the peninsula were to become experts on the subject, whether we liked it or not.
Landon Park Lane, Memoirs of a Crimean Veteran.
I told Mr. Park Lane that you had hemorrhagic fever, but he didn't believe me,
said Liz on reception at the Finnis. The flu would have been more believable. Liz was unrepentant.
He sent you this.
She passed across an envelope. I was tempted just to throw it in the bin, but I felt slightly guilty about giving him a hard time when we had met the previous night. The envelope contained a numbered ticket for Richard III, which played every Friday evening at the Ritz Theatre. We used to attend almost every week when we were going out together. It was a good show. The audience made it even better.
When did you last go out with him?
Asked Liz, sensing my indecision. I looked up. 10 years ago.
10 years? Go, darling. Most of my boyfriends would have trouble even remembering that long.
I looked at the ticket again. The show began in an hour.
Is that why you left Swindon?
Asked Liz, keen to be of some help. I nodded.
And did you keep a photo of him all those years?
I nodded again.
I see, replied Liz thoughtfully. I'll call a cab while you go and change.
It was good advice, and I trotted off to my room, had a quick shower, and tried on almost everything in my wardrobe. I put my hair up, then down again, then up once more, muttered, "Too boyish," and a pair of trousers, and slipped into a dress. I selected some earrings that Landon had given me and locked my automatic in the room safe. I just had time to put on a small amount of eyeliner before I was whisked through the streets of Swindon by a taxi driver, an ex-marine involved in the retaking of Balaclava in 61. We chatted about the Crimea. He didn't know where Colonel Phelps was going to talk either, but when he found out, he said he would heckle for all his worth. The Ritz looked a good deal shabbier. I doubted whether it had been repainted at all since we were last here. The gold-painted plaster mouldings around the stage were dusty and unwashed, the curtains stained with the rainwater that had leaked in. No other play but Richard III had been performed here for over 15 years, and the theatre itself had no company to speak of, just a backstage crew and a prompter. All the actors were pulled from an audience who had been to the play so many times they knew it back to front. Casting was usually done only half an hour before curtain up. Occasionally, seasoned actors and actresses would make guest appearances, although never by advance booking. If they were at a loose end late Friday night, perhaps after their performance at one of Swindon's 3 other theatres, they might come along and be selected by the manager as an impromptu treat for audience and cast. Just the week before, a local Richard III had found himself playing opposite Lola Vavoom, currently starring in the musical stage version of Fancy Free in Ludlow at the Swindon Crucible. It had been something of a treat for him. He didn't need to buy dinner for a month. Landon was waiting for me outside the theatre. It was 5 minutes to curtain up, and the actors had already been chosen by the manager, plus one in reserve in case anybody had a bad attack of the nerves and started chucking up in the bathroom.
"Thanks for coming," said Landon.
"Yeah," I replied, kissing him on the cheek and taking a deep breath of his aftershave. It was Bodmin. I recognized the earthy scent.
"How was your first day?" he asked.
"Kidnappings, vampires, shot dead a suspect, lost a witness to a gunman, Goliath tried to have me killed, puncture on the car, usual shit."
"A puncture? Really?"
"Not really. I made that bit up. Listen, I'm sorry about yesterday. I think I'm taking my work a bit too seriously."
If you weren't, agreed Landon with an understanding smile, I'd really start worrying. Come on, it's nearly curtain up.
He took my arm in a familiar gesture that I liked and led me inside. The theatre-goers were chattering noisily, the brightly coloured costumes of the unchosen actors in the audience giving a gala flavour to the occasion. I felt the electricity in the air and realised how much I had missed it. We found our seats. When was the last time you were here? I asked, when we were comfortable.
With you, replied Landon, standing up and applauding wildly as the curtain opened to a wheezing alarum.
I did the same. A compere in a black cloak with red lining swept onto the stage.
Welcome, all you will-loving R3 fans, to the Ritz at Swindon, where tonight, drumroll, for your delectation, for your gratification, for your edification, for your jollification, for your Shakespeareification, we will perform Will's Richard III for the audience, to the audience, by the audience.
The crowd cheered, and he held up his hands to quieten them.
But before we start, let's give a big hand to Ralph and Thea Swanavon, who are attending for their 200th time.
The crowd applauded wildly as Ralph and Thea walked on. They were dressed as Richard and Lady Anne and bowed and curtsied to the audience, who threw flowers onto the stage.
Ralph has played Dick the Shit 27 times and Creepy Clarence 12 times. Thea has been Lady Anne 31 times and Margaret 8 times.
The audience stamped their feet and whistled.
So, to commemorate their bicentennial, they will be playing opposite each other for the first time.
They respectively bowed and curtsied once more as the audience applauded and the curtains closed, jammed, opened slightly, and closed again. There was a moment's pause, and then the curtains reopened, revealing Richard at the side of the stage. He limped up and down the boards, eyeing the audience malevolently, past a particularly ugly prosthetic nose.
Ham!
Yelled someone at the back. Richard opened his mouth to speak, and the whole audience erupted in unison.
When is the winter of our discontent?
Now, replied Richard with a cruel smile. Is the winter of our discontent?
A cheer went up to the chandeliers high in the ceiling. The play had begun. Landon and I cheered with them. Richard III was one of those plays that could repeal the law of diminishing returns. It could be enjoyed over and over again.
Made glorious summer by this son of York, continued Richard, limping to the side of the stage. On the word summer,
600 people placed sunglasses on and looked up at an imaginary sun.
And all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean, buried.
When were our brows bound?
Yelled the audience.
Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, continued Richard, ignoring them completely.
We must have been to this show 30 times, and even now I could feel myself mouthing the words with the actor on the stage.
To the lascivious pleasing of a lute, continued Richard, saying lute loudly as several other members of the audience gave alternative suggestions.
Piano!
Shouted out one person near us.
Bagpipes! Said another.
Someone at the back, missing the cue entirely, shouted in a high voice,
Euphonium!
Halfway through the next line, and was drowned out when the audience yelled,
Pick a card!
As Richard told them that he
was not shaped for sportive tricks.
Landon looked across at me and smiled. I returned the smile instinctively.
I was enjoying myself.
I that am rudely stamped, muttered Richard, as the audience took its cue and stamped the ground with a crash that reverberated around the auditorium.
Landon and I had never wanted to tread the boards ourselves, and had never troubled to dress up. The production was the only show at the Ritz. It was empty the rest of the week. Keen amateur thespians and Shakespeare fans would drive from all over the country to participate, and it was never anything but a full house. A few years back, a French troupe performed the play in French to rapturous applause. A troupe went to Sauvignon a few months later to repay the gesture.
And that so lamely and unfashionable, the dogs bark at me.
The audience barked loudly, making a noise like feeding time at the dog's home. Outside in the alley, several cats new to the vicinity momentarily flinched, while more seasoned moggies looked at each other with a knowing smile. The play went on, the actors doing sterling work, and the audience parrying with quips that ranged from the intelligent to the obscure to the downright vulgar. When Clarence explained that the king was convinced that,
by the letter G, his issue disinherited shall be,
the audience yelled out,
Gloucester begins with G, dummy!
And when the Lady Anne had Richard on his knees in front of her with his sword at his throat, the audience encouraged her to run him through. And just before one of Richard's nephews, the young Duke of York, alluded to Richard's hump,
Uncle, my brother mocks both you and me, because that I am little, like an ape, he thinks that you should bear me on your shoulders.
The audience yelled out,
Don't mention the hump, kid!
And after he did,
The tower! The tower!
The play was the Garrick cut, and lasted only about 2.5 hours. At Bosworth Field, most of the audience ended up on the stage, as they helped reenact the battle. Richard, Catesby and Richmond had to finish the play in the aisle as the battle raged about them. A pink pantomime horse appeared on cue when Richard offered to swap his kingdom for just such a beast, and the battle finally ended in the foyer. Richmond then took one of the girls from behind the ice cream counter as his Elizabeth and continued his final speech from the balcony, with the audience below hailing him as the new King of England. The soldiers who had fought on Richard's side proclaiming their new allegiance. The play ended with Richmond saying,
God say Amen!
Amen! Said the crowd amid happy applause. It had been a good show. The cast had done a fine job. And fortunately, this time, no one had been seriously injured during Bosworth. Landon and I filed out quickly, and found a table in a cafe across the road. Landon ordered 2 coffees, and we looked at one another.
You're looking good, Thursday. You've aged better than me.
Nonsense, I replied. Look at these lines.
Laughter lines, asserted Landon.
Nothing's that funny.
Are you here for good? He asked suddenly.
I don't know, I answered. I dropped my gaze. I had promised myself I wouldn't feel guilty about leaving, but it depends.
On?
I looked at him and raised an eyebrow. On Speshops? The coffee arrived at that point, and I smiled brightly. So, how have you been?
I've been good, he said,
then added in a lower tone.
I've been lonely, too. Very lonely. I'm not getting any younger, either. How have you been?
I wanted to tell him that I'd been lonely, too. But some things can't easily be said. I wanted him to know that I still wasn't happy with what he had done. Forgive and forget is all very well, but no one was going to forgive and forget my brother. Anton's dead name was Mud, and that was solely down to Landon. I've been fine. I thought about it. I haven't, actually.
I'm listening.
I'm having a shitty time right now. I lost two colleagues in London. I'm chasing after a lunatic who most people think is dead. Mycroft and Polly have been kidnapped. Goliath is breathing down my neck, and the regional commander at Spech Ops might just have my badge. As you can see, things are just peachy.
Compared to the Crimea,
this is small beer Thursday. You're stronger than all this crap. Landon stirred three sugars into his coffee, and I looked at him again. Are you hoping for us to get back together? He was taken aback by the directness of my question. He shrugged.
I don't think we were ever truly apart.
I knew exactly what he meant. Spiritually, we never were.
I can't apologize any more, Thursday. You lost a brother. I lost some good friends, my whole platoon, and a leg. I know what Anton means to you, but I saw him pointing up the wrong valley to Colonel Frobisher just before the armored column moved off. It was a crazy day and crazy circumstances, but it happened, and I had to say what I saw. I looked him squarely in the eye.
Before going to the Crimea, I thought that death was the worst thing that could happen to anyone. I soon realized it was only for starters. Anton died. I can accept that. People get killed in war. It's inevitable. Okay. So it was a military debacle of staggering proportions. They also happen from time to time. It's happened many times before in the Crimea.
Thursday, implored Landon. What I said, it was the truth.
I rounded on him angrily. Who can say what the truth was? The truth is whatever we are most comfortable with. The dust, the heat, the noise. Whatever happened that day, the truth is now what everyone reads in the history books. What you told the military inquiry. Anton may have made a mistake, but he wasn't the only one that day.
I saw him point down the wrong valley Thursday.
He would never have made that mistake. I felt an anger I hadn't felt for 10 years. Anton had been blamed for the charge. It was as simple as that. The military leaders managed to squirm out of their responsibilities once again, and my brother's name had entered the national memory and the history books as that of the man who lost the light armored brigade. The commanding officer and Anton had both died in the charge. It had been up to Landon to tell the story. I got up.
Walking out again, Thursday, said Landon sardonically. Is this how it will always be? I was hoping you would have mellowed, that we could have made something out of this mess, that there was still enough love in us to make it work.
I shot a furious look at him. What about loyalty, Landon? He was your greatest friend.
And I still said what I said, sighed Landon. One day you'll have to come to terms with the fact that Anton fucked up. It happens, Thursday. It happens.
I stared at him, and he stared back.
Can we ever get over this, Thursday? I need to know, as a matter of some urgency.
Urgency? What urgency?
No, I replied. No, no, we can't. I'm sorry to have wasted your fucking precious time.
I ran out of the cafe, eyes streaming and angry with myself, angry with Landon and angry with Anton. I thought about Snood and Tamworth. We should all have waited for backup. Tamworth and I fucked up by going in, and Snood fucked up by taking on an enemy which he knew he was not physically or mentally prepared to face. We had all been flushed with excitement by the chase. It was the sort of impetuous action that Anton would have taken. I had felt it once before in the Crimea, and I had hated myself for it then, too. I got back to the Finis at about 1 in the morning. The John Milton weekend was ending with a disco. I took the lift up to my room, the distorted beat of the music softening to a dull thud as I was transported upward. I leaned against the mirror in the lift and took solace in the coolness of the glass. I should never have come back to Swindon. That much was obvious. I would speak to Victor in the morning and transfer out as soon as possible. I opened my room door and kicked off my shoes, lay on the bed and stared at the polystyrene ceiling tiles, trying to come to terms with what I had always suspected but never wanted to face. My brother had fucked up. Nobody had bothered to put it so simply before. The military tribunal spoke of tactical errors in the heat of the battle and gross incompetence. Somehow, fucked up made it seem more believable. We all make mistakes at some time in our lives, some more than others. It is only when the cost is counted in human lives that people really take notice. If Anton had been a baker and forgotten the yeast, nothing would have been made of it, but he would have fucked up just the same. As I lay there thinking, I slowly drifted into sleep, and with sleep came troubled dreams. I was back at Styx's apartment block, only this time I was standing outside the back entrance with the upturned car, Commander Flanker, and the rest of the SO1 interview panel. Snood was there too. He had an ugly hole in his wrinkled forehead and was standing, arms crossed and looking at me as if I had taken his football and he had sought out Flanker for some kind of redress. "Are you sure you didn't tell Snood to go and cover the back?" asked Flanker. "Positive," I said, looking at them both in turn.
"She did, you know," said Acheron as he walked past. "I heard her."
Flanker stopped him.
"Did you? What exactly did she say?"
Acheron smiled at me and then nodded at Snood, who returned his greeting.
"Wait," I interrupted. "How can you believe what he says? The man's a liar."
Acheron looked offended, and Flanker turned to me with a steely gaze.
"We only have your word for that next."
I could feel myself boil with inner rage at the unfairness of it all. I was just about to cry out and wake up when I felt a tap on my arm. It was a man dressed in a dark coat. He had heavy black hair that fell over his dour, strong features. I knew immediately who he was.
"Mr. Rochester?"
He nodded in return. But now we were no longer outside the warehouses in the East End. We were in a well-furnished hall, lit by the dim glow of oil lamps and the flickering light from a fire in the large hearth.
"Is your arm well, Miss Next?" he asked.
"Very well, thanks," I said, moving my hand and wrist to demonstrate.
"I should not trouble yourself with them," he added, indicating Flanker, Acheron and Snood, who had started to argue in the corner of the room near the bookcase. "They are merely in your dream, and thus being illusory are of no consequence."
"And what about you?" Rochester smiled, a forced, gruff smile. He was leaning on the mantelpiece and looked into his glass, swirling his Madeira delicately.
"I was never real to begin with."
He placed the glass on the marble mantel and flipped out a large silver hunter, popped it open, read the time, and returned it to his waistcoat pocket in one smooth, easy movement.
"Things are becoming more urgent. I can feel it. I trust I can count on your fortitude when the time comes."
"What do you mean?"
"I can't explain. I don't know how I managed to get here, or even how you managed to get to me. You remember when you were a little girl, when you chanced upon us both that chill winter's evening?"
I thought about the incident at Haworth all those years ago, when I entered the book of Jane Eyre and caused Rochester's horse to slip. It was a long time ago.
"Not to me. You remember?"
"I remember."
"Your intervention improved the narrative."
"I don't understand."
"Before, I simply bumped into my Jane and we spoke briefly."
"If you had read the book prior to your visit, you would have noticed."
When the horse slipped to avoid you, it made the meeting more dramatic. Wouldn't you agree?
But hadn't that happened already?
Rochester smiled. Not at all. But you weren't the first visitor we have had, and you won't be the last, if I'm correct.
What do you mean?
He picked up his drink again.
You are about to rouse from your sleep, Miss Next, so I shall bid you adieu. Again, I can trust in your fortitude when the time comes.
I didn't have time to answer or question him further. I was woken by my early morning call. I was in my clothes from the previous evening, the light and the television still on.